Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with my partner, Francis Schott. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, or just through restaurantguysradio.com. Morning, Francis.
Hey there, Mark.
How you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How's life today?
Life is pretty fabulous. You know, there's big news.
Yeah, what's the big news?
They're changing the Oreo.
Thank goodness.
They're changing the Oreo, Mark.
It's about freaking time. Come on.
They're going to make it into food.
Yeah. Hip, hip, hooray.
Let me tell you what's in the news today. I want to read you about changing the Oreo. There are a bunch of things going on in the food world. And, you know, all positive. You know, when we're, you know, the restaurant guys, we're talking about
restaurants. All the things going on in the food world are not positive. Sorry, friend.
There are a few positive things going on, and that's quite a change. So we can focus on them here. But one of the things that's interesting, and we've spent, I don't know, several shows recently talking about some actual good things that have happened on the legislative front, mostly statewide, and I challenged people to show me something good that the federal government was doing, because what's going on with the federal government is usually not a lot of good things. And they did. Federal labeling requirements.
Your political slant is appearing on the show.
The federal government's bigger. Bigger is more room to be corrupt. And the Agriculture Department is a morass of corrupt, evil, you know, people subsidizing huge agribusiness farms, and the Secretary of Agriculture, former Secretary of Agriculture, Ann Veneman's just an evil.
So how do you feel about it exactly?
I'm holding back.
Okay.
I am.
You know, I know him, and he is holding back.
I am indeed holding back.
And let me tell you, I appreciate it.
Let me talk about the good for a change.
Talk about good for a change.
There's no good in the world. Okay, here's what's going on. Because of federal labeling requirements and because of increased awareness that brought those labeling requirements about, very soon manufactured foods are going to have on the label the trans fats, that the amount of trans fats that they have.
And obviously some places are doing it already.
And some people are doing it already. And you know what they're doing? You know what a lot of these food producers are doing? They're taking their stuff that they've been trying to foist on you, and they've been fighting these labeling changes all along. They don't want to listen to
trans fats. Because they know if you see what's actually in there, you'll never buy it again.
So you know what they're doing now? They're changing them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all of them that said, oh, well, you know, there's no reason that we should have to label the trans fats in there. It doesn't make any difference. Well, if it doesn't make any difference, why are they changing their recipes? But I think that overall, I can be cynical even when I'm talking about something good. But
it's a skill like anything else.
But here's what's happening. Let me read to you the big announcement from the Oreo cookie people, Kraft. After nearly 100 years of polluting our arteries, Kraft Foods announced that the Oreo would soon be fabricated completely without trans fats. They said it was impossible, right? Guess what? It's not impossible.
I'm guessing after 100 years of polluting our arteries was not a press release from Oreo. Is that true?
I got this from online, and I think I can attribute it. I don't want to say for sure, but I think it came from New York Magazine online. But
so it wasn't a press release from Oreo?
No. But it's a huge story for a lot of reasons. For one thing, they're doing it before. It'll be a marginally healthier cookie. But to do it beforehand, it represents a great movement forward in American food. Let me read a little more from this article. It says, by removing the trans fat from the Oreo, a beloved mass-produced Franken cookie assembled in laboratories rather than bakeries, this will be the latest edible product to move closer to actually being food. Now, why are trans fats in food? Why do people put trans fats in food? It's because they last forever. It's because they don't go bad. It's because regular fats mean that if you have a chocolate cookie and you make it out of it, usually, you know, you'll say, well, it has to be eaten in 30 days or 40 days. Well, you know, the Oreo says best eaten before the next millennium.
Right.
You know?
Well, that's how they last in your body as well, unfortunately.
And therein you have, my friend, the problem is that things aren't supposed to last in your body. For a year.
You know, I just have to put this plug in. There's a store, a really good store called Trader Joe's.
Uh-huh.
And Trader Joe's has had cookies, Oreo-like cookies without trans fats for years now, because they know that the problems that trans fat create for human beings, and that it's actually poison to our systems. And, you know, those are the cookies I buy for my kids. And you know, kids are going to have cookies. I'm going to have cookies.
Do you know what trans fats do? They not only clog your arteries themselves, but they eliminate the good cholesterol from
right.
your body. They eliminate the good fats, the mm-hmm. omega-3s. They compete with them and displace them, and they lodge in your system so that the omega-3s are rendered inactive when you finally do have a piece of salmon.
Correct.
And that's horrible.
It's horrible. And the fact that it's such, what I think that is horrible is that we as Americans don't know how much of these products are in the food that we eat every single day. Because they're in your Triscuits and they're in your Oreos and they're in anything that stays crunchy longer than it naturally should.
So the two things.
That's a good way for you to look at this. If something's still crunchy and you don't think it should be, probably has trans fats in it.
Trans fats, if you're looking for trans fats, what you'll see on the ingredients, if it says partially hydrogenated blank oil, the partially hydrogenated is the part that makes it a trans fatty acid as opposed to just being, non-trans fatty.
Mm-hmm.
Non-trans fatty acids are unsaturated fats, which are actually the good parts of it.
Right.
But the thing is, the good fats, you know, become rancid. But eat fresh food. Do you really need cookies that stay fresh for 7 months? Do you
yeah.
really need to have Pop-Tarts that stay fresh for 5 years,
years? It's funny because in that article that you're referring to, one of the things they say is, you know, a candy bar shelf life then is 1 month instead of 18 months.
Okay.
Exactly. Okay. I can eat a candy bar in a month. I'm sure of it.
What it said, actually, what it said in the article is said, you're not a cosmonaut stuck on the Mir space station for 2 years. You're a human being on Earth. Go buy a new candy bar.
It's time for, you know, would you do that with your steak? I mean, would you buy a piece of steak that you could keep in your refrigerator for a year?
And this is coming about because you out there in listener land, because we here on the radio station, because consumers overall are supporting Whole Foods and Wegmans, and we're going to our local farmers, and we're mm-hmm. caring about the food that we eat, and we're pressuring the government to make sure that they label it. And when they label it, they're going to, rather than put on the label that they're putting stuff that's really, 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 really bad for you,
mm-hmm.
they're going to take it out. And that's exactly how this should work. That's
yeah.
exactly what we want to happen.
We're not stupid. If you tell us the truth, we'll understand it.
And you know what? I might have an Oreo once a month,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not buying a huge bag of Oreo cookies for my kids
right.
Because I don't have any kids. But,
but if you had on that shelf, you had Oreos and you had Jozo's, which are the cookie that I'm talking about,
uh-huh.
No-brainer.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a no-brainer.
Right.
You're
going to
buy the cookies without the trans fats.
Well.
And because a month is enough time for me to eat a bag of cookies,
do you know,
believe it or not.
Do you know that also, and they're going to be a little more expensive because the grocer's got to be a little more
honestly, the Jozo's, not more expensive.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, you know, the other thing the trans fats do is they also add a little bit of metal to your body.
Mm-hmm. So, metal is sometimes good if
yeah,
you're
not,
low
not,
on iron.
Not, I don't think we're talking about iron, you know what I mean? Anyway, so the whole, I think this, and we have to congratulate the government and be happy about the fact that when your trans fats are going to be in your food, and there are a whole slew of these big companies who are making a headway. And they're still complaining, by the way, about this. I love this. They put here, Kraft would set out to set the trans fat free Oreo it claimed in recent news stories, Kraft, that putting the Oreo on a trans fat diet cost 2 years and tens of millions of dollars in research. Does Mr. Kraft live in a better house than I do?
I mean, think of what you saved on in heart disease. What you'll
exactly.
save in heart disease is going to
exactly.
be a lot more than 10
But my kid's
dollars.
Less likely to have a heart attack, so you know what? Well, but you know what the fact of the matter is? Look, if they want to keep making Oreos with trans fats in them, nobody's saying they can't.
Mm-hmm.
They're just saying that if you're going to make Oreos and you're going to put trans fats in it, you're going to put it on the label so I can make a choice.
So I can say, no, stop it.
And
I'm
that, you
not
know
buying
what?
That.
And that maybe some little cookie company somewhere that said, you know what? We're going to make something that's not going to put your kid in the hospital, and maybe I'll buy their cookie instead of yours.
That's great. Well, we're going to stop talking about cookies and start talking about wine in our next segment. We are going to talk about wine being made in a very peculiar reason.
Region?
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey. Time is 11:15.
Hello, welcome back, everybody. You're talking to The Restaurant Guys once again. And we were talking earlier in the show about trans fats and how the big companies are moving away from trans fats, and we're moving to a trans-fat-free Oreo, and that's good for the world and good for your health. And good for your health in so many ways. Another thing that's very good for you is wine, and so we're going to turn the topic of our conversation to wine overall, one of my favorite topics.
Which I actually like better than Oreos anyway.
Yeah, yeah. It's true. Wine and Oreos go well together, but no, they don't. I totally made that up. You may not realize that wine is grown in some unusual places, and wine grapes are grown in some unusual places. And one of the more interesting American viticultural areas, which are the areas in which wine is grown, like Napa Valley is a viticultural area, Sonoma is a viticultural area. But one of the more interesting viticultural areas in California is Bel Air. I bet you didn't realize that wine is being grown in Bel Air. And wine is being grown in Bel Air by a gentleman named Tom Jones. Tom and Ruth Jones have owned property there since 1959, and in 1978, the Joneses realized that the wine-growing potential of the Moraga Canyon and the microclimate and soil found there are particular to the canyon, different from the rest of California, and similar to the conditions found in Bordeaux. And so they planted vines. Most people plant mansions. They planted vines. So we have with us on the line Tom Jones from Bel Air. Hi, Tom.
How are you? Tom Jones here.
Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time to talk to us. Now, you have a vineyard in Bel Air. That's rather extravagant. Don't you find?
No, we bought the property in 1959 when, believe me, prices were a small fraction of what they are today. And
right.
And this was originally a horse ranch.
Uh-huh.
And there aren't many of those around now, but we bought this, as I say, 46 years ago when there were few around. And so, no, it was not expensive at all.
I bet you could put 30 mansions on it right now, though, and do all right.
Well, I wouldn't, because I love the land the way it is.
And we respect you for that. But let's
very
talk
much
about the land the way it is. I mean, it's pretty, obviously one of the things that this speaks of is that you're very dedicated to this particular parcel of land, and it must be very unique. And actually, in the spirit of, you know, total disclaimer here, I have met with Tom and had lunch with Tom and tasted the wines back to their earliest vintages, and they are phenomenal and very unique. Why, Tom?
Well, I mean, grapevines really respond to the area where they're planted. And
mm-hmm.
we find that even on our own property, there are 9 acres of grapes, 16 acres of property, depending on the location within that 9 acres, the effect on the wine taste is different. And this canyon has sunshine, a lot of sunshine.
Right.
And it's located about 8 miles from the ocean on one side and 4 miles from the desert on the other.
Uh-huh.
So we have warm afternoons and then cold nights.
And that's
and it's a very desirable thing for grapes because it gives them a chance to grow when the heat is on and then cool off and recuperate during the night. And I think that has a lot. And the soil, obviously, is different.
Now these wines you have, and one of the things that has been said of California wines is there are that many of the expensive California wines are not particularly age-worthy. Your wines, as I can personally attest, are particularly age-worthy. How do you do things differently, or how is your land different to bring that about?
Well, I can't speak. I know that the land does have the most effect on the quality of the grapes, but how they're processed, I don't think we process them any different than others. We're very careful when we pick the grapes to make sure they're absolutely at the right point to pick them. We don't pick them either overripe or underripe, but on the basis of flavor, and we try very hard to be careful in picking the grapes exactly when it's the right time to pick them.
And
that may have something to do with it.
And in your opinion, how long do your wines last?
Well, we don't know because the oldest bottles we've had are 20 years, and they're good, in good shape.
So, and I have to say, we did have lunch at Gramercy Tavern almost a year ago now, and wow, they really were phenomenal. Listen, we're going to talk in just a moment. We're talking with Tom Jones of Moraga Vineyards in California in Bel Air, California.
So, Tom, what are you growing out there as far as reds? What type of grape varieties?
Well, principally about 80%. Is Cabernet Sauvignon, and about 20% is Merlot.
Now, do you just make that one blend, or are you making other wines with that?
No, but we do have a white wine,
right,
which is Sauvignon Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
And you just started that recently, right?
Yes, about, well, 10 years ago.
Yeah,
yes.
First release was the 98 vintage, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Do you design that white wine to be as long age, or is it just the red wine that you designed to be kind of one that sticks around?
Well, you know, actually, the wine comes out, if you handle them properly, they have their own characteristic. And we hope that the wine will have a long age, but I don't know how you would handle the grapes to make sure they're long age. I can I think a winemaker can ruin grapes.
Yeah,
oh, sure. We've seen a lot of winemakers do that, Tom.
All right,
sure.
And so therefore we have a wonderful winemaker and he does everything right, and so the grapes come out perfectly. And both our white and red grapes are long livers, and we're very pleased by that.
You know, one of the things that I found about your wines, and I taste wines a lot. I mean, it's part of what I do for a living, and you know, I find that the wines are a very long age. One of the reasons is because they have a good amount of acidity. And I want to talk a little bit more about that when we come back from the break. Again, we are talking with Tom Jones of Moraga Vineyards in California, in Bel Air, California, where he has grown some pretty amazing grapes at a pretty unusual place. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25. The Restaurant Guys, we're here talking with Tom Jones of Moraga Vineyards in Bel Air, California. Tom, you have this property out in California, and obviously it was a long time ago, so it wasn't the neighborhood that it is today. But what made you decide that the Moraga Canyon was a place where you wanted to grow wine?
Well, we'd been living here before we planted the grapes, which is 1978. We'd been living here, 19 years. So we're very well acquainted with the climate, which had those characteristics that were conducive to grapes. And then the soil, and visiting Europe, and I visited a lot of the vineyards and really did a lot of business over there, so I had a chance to visit them. I found our soil was identical.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't similar, it was identical.
Yeah, you found yourself a pretty hot winemaker, too, and a guy by the name of Tony Soder.
Tony Soder, and then followed by the winemaker we have now, Scott Rich.
Right.
Worked for Tony Soder.
Worked for Tony for years and years. And then
years
started
and years,
doing his own
and
stuff.
He started helping on our wine, and then when Tony sold his business, Scott came with us full time.
That's great.
Yeah.
We want to point everybody out, if you want to know about Moraga wines, they're not actually in wide distribution, they're not inexpensive, but they're really fabulous, and I've had them back going years and years. If you want to find out more about Moraga Vineyards, you can check out our website at www.restaurantguysradio.com. Or you can go to moragavineyards.com, and there's really a lot of great information out there.
And Tom, you've really created kind of a little cult following here for your wines as time has gone on. Why do you think that is so much?
Well, I don't know. Our wine is put it this way, it's a very friendly wine. It doesn't have any bad characteristics, thank God, and it has very good ones. And it doesn't hit you in the face, but at the same time, it's elegant, and it's... It has a good beginning, good middle, and a good finish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of wines don't have those characteristics.
Yeah, unfortunately, most of them don't have those characteristics. But it does come from the soil. And I think it takes a lot of guts to stand up to the developers and the people who might want to put, you know, giant mansions on that property and pay you tons of money for it.
Well, it wasn't hard for us. Both my wife and I are native Californians, and we loved growing up here.
Yeah.
And we just wanted to preserve a bit of it.
Yeah.
That's what we've done, and we love it.
You know, the thing they were saying about wine, you know, they say there's that old saying, you can't save time in a, if I can save time in a bottle, you can save time in a bottle with Moraga Vineyards. You can drink a little bit of what Tom is doing out there.
Well, Tom, thanks so much for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure, and thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Take care.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott, and I'm here with Mark Pascal. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we are here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every day from 11 a.m. to 12 noon, and reach us through restaurantguysradio.com. Hi there, Mark.
Hey. Tom Jones is a pretty interesting guy.
You forgot my name.
No.
You forgot my name. You said, hey, and you forgot my name.
I said, hey, Tom Jones.
whoa. Don't do that all along. We just had as a guest in the last segment of the last show, we had Tom Jones, who owns a canyon in Bel Air, in California.
You have to give him some credit, okay? I'm sure that people have offered him hundreds of millions of dollars for 19 acres in Bel Air.
You know what's funny?
I'm sure of it.
Huh, what do you got? I got a 10,000 square foot home in Bel Air. What do you got? Got a canyon? I do give him a lot of credit. I think it's really great. I mean, obviously, it's not about money. That's not the reason he's doing this. He believes in the wine from the canyon. He's been there since 59. He grew up there. And thank heavens that somebody like that has the resources to be able to do what he's doing. And the wine is really great. And you can find out more about that by going to MoragaVineyards.com.
Again, be aware, these wines are super expensive.
Yeah,
we're into the super premium now.
They are. But also, I have tasted these wines going back 20 years. We did a vertical tasting. I was fortunate enough to be invited about a year ago to a vertical tasting with our friend Harmon Skernick at Gramercy Tavern in New York. And we had lunch with about, I don't know, 15 wine buyers, 20 wine buyers, and Tom Jones. And boy, those wines were just the older wines that age like a great Bordeaux. They're really, really fabulous. You know, when we were talking to Tom, I was struck by an article that appeared in the New York Times way back in March of this year.
Weren't you paying attention to Tom? Why were you reading articles?
Talking to Tom jogged my memory, and it brought back an article that was done in the New York Times Magazine on wine. And I thought it was interesting because it got fairly technical, but it talked about when people build cellars. Mm-hmm. And in the New World, obviously, cellars are extant all over the old world, and some of the most striking cellars I've ever been in are in Champagne, where Champagne, the subsoil of Champagne is chalk.
I was in a really cool one in the Loire Valley.
Uh-huh.
That was an old troglodyte cave.
Really?
And then they built the wine cellar right off of the troglodyte
wow.
cave. Really cool in the Loire Valley.
Well, in Champagne, the ones that I were in were interesting. They're carved out of chalk, the old Roman chalk mines, mm-hmm. because they... So they date back to Roman times. In the times of the Roman Empire, they would mine chalk there, and they would carve, because chalk is so pliable, they would charge buttresses and balustrades out of the chalk. And these cellars were so deep that sometimes in one of the cellars that I was in, you could see all the way up to a window that was like two stories up, that was, of course, just barely sticking out of the ground. And there were these beautiful, and everything is, of course, white.
Yeah.
And absolutely
very
one
striking.
Of the most remarkable things.
Striking.
And the other thing about it's interesting about the champagne cups is when you're down there, if you spit your wine into the wall, it just wicks away.
When we're tasting wine frequently so we don't get drunk, we'll taste wine and then spit it out so that we can taste a lot of different wines. And it's accepted in our business, believe me, and we all have to do it so we can taste a lot of wines on a given day.
But I was reading how in the New World, people are trying to build cellars and carve cellars out of mountains. And there's some interesting stuff here. Until recently, the only wine caves in Napa Valley were a few dug in the 19th century, but because of the building codes out there, they are more and more... Mm-hmm. Wineries are going underground because they don't want to destroy the landscape or the way things look. But this stuff is really expensive. What a wine cellar does is it keeps things at 57 degrees, and it keeps the humidity right as well for winemaking. So often people move their whole winemaking operation underground, and
right.
it removes the cost of air conditioning, humidity control, all that sort of stuff. And so it can be, it's never really makes a lot of sense because it costs hundreds of thousands of dollars and takes years and years. And they have these monstrous machines called road headers. They look like a cross between a bulldozer and a tank.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a massive boom in the front in which two rotating hemispheres studded with metal spikes grind the rock face to rubble.
Yeah.
Once the tunnel's dug, they build the Holland Tunnel or the tunnel.
Connecting England to France.
And
same type of equipment.
And depending on the day, depending on the type of dirt you're digging through, they can dig 15 feet a day, or they might have to go as slow as 8 inches a day.
That would be slow.
And there is a winery out there that I won't mention the name of, but they didn't do their geological surveys properly, and they dug into the side of a mountain, a phenomenally expensive multi-year project.
Well, the good news is when you're done, you have a perfect place to store your wine because you've dug into the earth and it's absolutely perfect
57 degrees
wise and humidity wise for to store wine.
Right, you don't need insulation. You want to be in the dirt.
It's perfect.
Unless, of course, there's geothermal activity under the mountain, and then it's 80 degrees under the ground. And that's what this winery did.
Ouch.
So they had built this cellar that cost an amazing amount of money, and I sort of was pointed out to me that they have these huge air conditioners outside.
Okay. We got people got to realize this is a planet. Okay. And if you dig a hole and lava starts bubbling up out of it, stop digging.
I think the geothermal activity was more water and things like that. But unbelievable. Isn't that amazing?
It is tragic is what it is. It's not amazing. It's tragic. And that would just kill me if I
know.
I mean, somebody spent millions of dollars to build these caves for the purpose of course, aesthetically, to have a place to showcase their wines, but to store their wines in perpetuity and never have to worry about them again, and they have to air condition them and continue to worry about
tremendous,
it.
Tremendous cost.
As if it were a warehouse below the ground.
Listen, when you're at home and you're thinking about having a wine cellar, putting wines out in your wine cellar, of course, you can buy all sorts of units that heat and cool, and Mark and I give advice to people a lot on home wine cellars and how to put them together. Actually, if you'd like to hire us as a consultant, you can check us out at therestaurantguysradio.com. We do that kind of work for people. But we also, one of the things that's very interesting is people say, oh, I have a cellar.
Are you done with the commercial now?
I'll put my wine. Yeah, I am.
Excellent.
I don't know. Are the phones lit up? But people will say, you know, I have a wine cellar, I have a cellar. I'll just store the wines down there. Not so fast, Spanky. You have to be careful. What you're looking for is something that has a constant temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Most cellars in New Jersey aren't dug deep enough to get that constant temperature.
Right. Also, the other thing we like to do in New Jersey is put our equipment in the basement. So you may have a hot water heater that's nearby.
Or you may have your finished basement, and that's not a wine cellar. And the other thing that you might have down there is you might have some equipment that vibrates, like the washing machine.
Correct.
Vibration, bad for aging wine. What you need is a cool, consistent temperature, dark, vibration-free place. Now,
a little damp helps, too.
Some people may have old houses that have cellars that work, and what that usually happens is if you put things up against an outside wall and your cellar's deep enough and you insulate a place to put your wine, it works really well. What we always recommend is that people insulate something that is against an outside wall like that in a corner, and then it's fairly simple and inexpensive to put up a room around that and temperature control that room. It's not as fancy as the multi-thousand-dollar refrigeration unit, but it works just as well, even better, actually. And they have low-impact refrigeration units that you put in the wall there, and that just blows the hot air out into the room.
And you can do some really fine things down there. You can build some shelves. You can build equipment to hold your wines and to monitor what's in the cellar.
The thing that you must keep in mind most, though, is what you want is a constant temperature. It's got to be below 65, 70 degrees, but it's better to have something at 68 degrees all the time than to have something that's 65 during the day and 55 in the evening.
Yeah, I think that's another fatal flaw that people make when they're putting their cellars in, is that sometimes what happens is you have you're so concerned about it being cool that you're not concerned about it being constant.
Yeah.
And constant is a much bigger issue than cool. Better to keep your wines at 65 all the time than keep them at 55 to 45 to 55 to 45.
And just in case you think we're getting a little fussy out here, I'm not talking about necessarily having a wine cellar that costs a lot of money. If you like wine and you have a case of wine that you just want to keep downstairs to have on hand when people come over, even if it's an expensive wine, you'd be surprised at how quickly okay wine is turned into really substandard wine by not storing it properly and also by serving it. I mean, when you have your wine down at cellar temperature, you bring a bottle of red wine up, it's a little bit cool, you put it on the kitchen table, and you drink it, it's really great. If you have it in the garage, it's just not going to be so good.
Right, and in your kitchen, a lot of people have those little wine racks in their kitchen, either, the worst place is like above the stove, but above the refrigerator.
Above the refrigerator. All the heat comes out of the refrigerator, goes up the top, and blows over your wine. The architect who invented that should be put in jail.
Well, it's certainly not good for your wine. And that's
Let's get
really
him on the show.
The worst place to store your wine.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Hello and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Today we've been talking a little bit about wine and wine cellars. But, Francis, I need to go a little bit off topic because I read a really disturbing article while you were away. And I've been trying to find a little bit of time to talk about it. And I say now's as good as any. Did you see this article that I left for you on fish? And is it worth the risk or reward? That's creepy.
That's very scary, Mark.
That's creepy.
Why don't you tell people what it's about?
Well, what the study's about is it's really focuses on pregnant women eating fish. But pregnant women eating fish, but by eating fish and the omega-3s and the beneficial properties that fish has in our diets, we can raise our baby's intelligence by adding fish to their diets. And I think that's really remarkable, and it's a great thing, and I'm glad that we've done this study so we can see the foods that help us create more intelligent children in utero. Fantastic, right?
Yeah.
Well, if the fish is too high in mercury,
uh-huh.
And we know that
all
that
fish is too high, somewhat high
that
in mercury.
Most most fish today have some mercury, and the larger the fish, generally, the more mercury they have. And
yeah.
That's just a very blanketing rule,
got it. We'll go with it. We'll use it as a working premise.
Premise. A premise. Thank you. The fish that are high in mercury, what they do is the opposite effect.
They lower your baby's intelligence.
They lower your baby's intelligence. So you can eat fish, which you are presuming is doing good things for your fetus, and actually the mercury in the fish, if the mercury level is at a certain point, will reduce it. Let me read for you a little piece of an article that I pulled out of the Star Ledger just last week. For each additional serving of fish each week, the baby's intelligence scores increased by 4 points, or an average of almost 7%. But for every increase of one part per million of mercury, the baby's intelligence score dropped by 7.5 points, or 12.5%. A woman could raise her mercury level by one part per million if she ate an average-sized serving of swordfish once a week.
Oh, my God. What is wrong with us?
What are we doing? What are we doing?
You know, no one noticed that this year the United States Department of Agriculture came out and said, yeah, all fish everywhere in the world is contaminated, even in pristine lakes because of the air pollution.
Awful.
So don't eat too much fish, everybody. And you know, everybody said, oh, okay, I guess I'll cut back on the fish.
It's funny because I was really never an environmentalist. I really said, you know what?
But then you started reading.
It's a big planet. It heals itself very well, and that's true. Okay, we're in a big planet that heals itself very well.
But
we got to get sensible. I mean, there's got to be some kind of. We know that the mercury that's in the oceans is being caused by us.
Of course it is.
Okay.
There's no mercury out there.
Well, there is mercury out there.
But there's not mercury. Like, it's coming from our power plants. And now it's coming from the third world's power plants. And you know what I don't want to hear? I don't want to hear, well, we can't stop mercury emissions because then if the third world doesn't do it, then it'll hurt our economy. So I guess we just have to poison the planet and all die. But we don't want to die any poorer than anybody else.
You just read a study that originally came out in the Los Angeles Times that if you eat one piece of swordfish a week while you're pregnant, you can reduce your baby's IQ by 7.5 points. One piece of fish a week.
Yeah. And
it's criminal.
Of course it's criminal.
It's criminal that our government and the powers that be.
And the other
and
governments
us,
are.
And
we.
Us. You and me.
Listen, you're driving your SUV? You're putting more mercury out there than you need.
We need to change what we do. We need to start buying hybrid vehicles.
And
we
you know what?
Change the gas consumption. We need to change
and we need to,
the things
we,
that we're doing.
We need to have a Clean Air Act that's really a Clean Air Act. We can't be weakening it. We need to be strengthening it. And we need to do whatever we can to reduce these kinds of emissions. And you know what? You said something really interesting that I've had this discussion with people who are really not who disagree with me environmentally, and they say, it's the economy, things will get better, the planet has always been able to purge itself.
The economy is super important.
Super important. But the long view of the economy is to have good ecology. Good ecology and good economy are the same, but they need a longer view, and that's why we need government to get involved, because the private sector is great at making short-term decisions. We need to come together as a people and make some long-term decisions. And for the people who say the planet has always been able to right itself, the planet is always able to absorb anything, yes, and I believe it will. Sadly, please consider, however, that one of the ways that this planet may right itself is by taking the pathogens, which are us, and getting rid of us, okay? Because the planet doesn't care whether we're here or not. And sure, we may destroy all sorts of life forms, and we may eventually become so onerous on the planet that we put ourselves into extinction.
Mm-hmm.
But that may be how the planet brings itself back into balance. Let's not let that happen, you know?
We need
all the fish in the world everywhere are polluted. Okay, have we done enough? Is it time now that we can start paying attention? Boy, I'm up on my high horse.
But how's things down there? How'd they get the horse in the studio?
The same article says 630,000 babies a year are born with mercury exposure that could reduce their mental abilities. 630,000.
That's in America?
Okay, no, that's around across the world. But that's unbelievable. One in six people in the United States has mercury levels in excess of the amount that EPA says is safe.
So what that means is look at your family. Do you have more than six people in your family? Well, one of you has mercury in your body higher than the EPA says is safe for a fetus to have. And you know what? While if you may not be a fetus, if it's that dangerous to a fetus, it's somewhat dangerous to you. All right, you're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We're going to come back and talk about cheery things like summer lemonade with no mercury in it when we come back from the break. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Talking about the damage we can do to our unborn fetuses with the wrong kind of fish.
I just got off my high horse before. Did you hear me? I got really mad. Well, all
mercury,
the fish.
We're crazy.
Come all on. The fish in the world are poisoned.
We're doing it. We're putting mercury into the water.
Really? You think that's how it's getting there? Okay. You know, then let's talk about lemonade. You ever see those old commercials, the Country Time Lemonade and the grandpa and the little girl? They talk about Country Time Lemonade and it's just like grandma used to make. Did your grandma use fructose? Because my grandma didn't. Did your grandma use stabilizers or artificial flavors?
High fructose corn syrup.
I don't remember that.
Grandma always put a little dollop of that in.
What country?
That's what makes it great.
Yeah, right. That's what makes it great. What country was that Country Time in? You know how my grandma made it? Lemons, sugar, water.
Yeah.
There you go. High fructose corn syrup, bad. High fructose corn syrup, bad for a lot of reasons. One, it's bad for the planet to produce it. Two, it's only cheap because it's subsidized by the government. Your tax dollars are going to pay big, giant corporate agribusiness farms to grow corn that they then turn into corn syrup.
But the reason they turn it into corn syrup?
Because we have too much.
Is because we have too much corn. It is almost the same price to produce sugar as it is to produce corn syrup. And as much as we rail on sugar, sugar is much better for us than high fructose corn syrup. Much better for
and
us.
If you want to make your homemade lemonade even a little better for your body, here's a little secret. You can use maple syrup. Now that's a little expensive, but you can use maple syrup, especially the B grade maple syrup as opposed to the A grade maple syrup, which you can find in health stores because it's less processed.
Yeah.
Really good stuff.
I'd like to tell you, that sounds disgusting.
No, it's good. It really is. But, you know, the standard recipe is sugar. Use fresh lemons.
It doesn't take that many lemons to make lemonade. Lemons are very, very potent.
And when life gives you lemons.
Squeeze a few lemons.
But you want a treat for your kids. You know, I'm amazed. Okay, so I got to go in the cabinet. I got to take out the powder. I got to put it in the thing. I got to shake it up and mix it up and put it in the refrigerator. Or
I squeeze four lemons.
Exactly.
Put some sugar
in. I go to the cabinet, I get the sugar, and I mix it up. I don't get it. I just don't get it. It's marketing, okay?
Yeah. It is marketing. That's what it is.
Real country lemonade. Put lemons, water, sugar, make it yourself, season to taste, treat your kids, make ice pops out of it. It's really good.
And you can get lemons all year round now. So.
And high fructose corn syrup, when you have it, when you drink it and all that stuff, it makes you want to come back. It makes you go, I want it back.
Sugar is addictive. High fructose corn syrup is even more addictive. Well, you've spent another hour listening to The Restaurant Guys.
I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.